Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
.org. Also available on our free KQED app.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, when Patricia Lockwood, author of Priest Daddy and No One Is Talking About This, fell ill with COVID in 2020, she says she felt insane for months, experiencing brain fog, which she named Brian Fog, and a single song lyric playing over and over in her mind, which she called The Refrains. In a new novel, Lockwood allows us to enter her mind, affected by long COVID, to feel the effects of an initially dismissed diagnosis and gain insights into what anchors us in deeply confusing times. It's called Will There Ever Be Another You? Join us.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Advisors are recommending the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention do away with a blanket guidance to immunize all babies against hepatitis B within the first 24 hours of life. Many public health experts say there's overwhelming evidence the universal vaccinations have been effective in protecting young children from being infected with a virus that can lead to liver diseases later in life. NPR's Rob Stein reports on why the advisory panel decided to re-examine hepatitis B vaccinations for infants.
This committee was put together by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has long questioned many vaccines and has launched a major review of all childhood vaccinations. Some members of this CDC committee argue that there's insufficient evidence that giving all newborns the vaccine when they're so young is really necessary, given that the hepatitis B vaccine is often spread through sex or drug use. They also question whether it's safe to immunize babies so early in life.
NPR. As Rob Stein reporting. The Supreme Court is clearing the way for Texas to use the 2025 redistricting map for its midterm congressional elections, but it does not guarantee Republican control of the House next year, as President Trump sought by pressing for Texas to redistrict in the first place. Houston Public Media, Andrew Schneider explains why.
Texas' move to redistrict its congressional map mid-decade set off a nationwide arms race to redistrict by both parties. Travis Crum is a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
The signal that gets sent with this case is going to reverberate in the legal challenges to California, future legal challenges to other mid-decade redistricting maps that are being filed across the country.
In addition to California, Democrats in Virginia and Maryland are considering mid-decade redistricting to counter Texas. Republican states that have followed Texas' lead include Missouri and North Carolina. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The European Union is fining X $140 million for what it has determined are breaches of the bloc's Digital Services Act. Terry Schultz reports the decision is the culmination of a two-year investigation into Elon Musk's company.
This is the first fine under the new EU legislation, the Digital Services Act, which regulators say X has violated in multiple areas regarding transparency. One is what it calls the deceptive nature of the blue check mark, which Elon Musk changed when he took over Twitter, from a sign the user's identity had been verified to something that could simply be purchased. European Commission spokesman Thomas Renier says that opens consumers to possible scams and manipulation.
It deceives users. Anyone can pay to obtain the verified status, and X does not meaningfully verify who is behind it.
X now has between 60 and 90 days to explain how it will address these concerns, as well as other charges, including allowing researchers access to public data. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
It's NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California is back in federal court this hour to challenge the ongoing federalization of the state's National Guard. KQED's Julie Small reports.
In September, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer ruled that the federalization of California's National Guard in Los Angeles this summer was illegal. His ruling has stayed pending an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. In the meantime, 300 guards are still under federal control. Rachel Van Cleve is a visiting professor at the McGeorge School of Law.
So I think from the state of California's point of view, this is a continued infringement on the state's sovereignty.
California is challenging an August 5th order from the Trump administration that extended the deployment of the remaining 300 National Guards through November. The deployment has since been extended again through February. I'm Julie Small, KQED News.
A UCSF social worker is in critical condition after being stabbed multiple times yesterday afternoon by a patient at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. Sheriff's officials say deputies were providing additional security to a doctor who had received threats from the arrested suspect when the stabbing occurred nearby. The suspect, a 35-year-old man, allegedly used a 5-inch kitchen knife. He was taken into custody at the scene. It was the second stabbing handled by the sheriff's office that afternoon. Around noon, deputies at County Jail No. 2 in San Francisco responded after an inmate stabbed another in the abdomen with a folding knife. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And the listeners of KQED. Dense fog advisory still in effect for the southern Sacramento Valley, Carquinez, Strait and Delta area, East Bay Interior Valleys as well, in effect till 11 this morning. It should be a mostly sunny day for the Bay Area today, highs mid-50s to low 60s, mostly cloudy for the southern Sacramento Valley.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When writer Patricia Lockwood got COVID in March of 2020, she experienced a mind-altering, long-lasting brain fog, and she wrote down her thoughts and some of the fear and confusion around her at that time, notes that would eventually become her latest novel, Will There Ever Be Another You? Quote, people were up at 3 a.m. contemplating the purchase of apple-flavored horse deworming paste, which had gone up to $30 a tube. People, or maybe just her, were becoming confused after they got out of the shower and applying large tracks of deodorant to the skin of their face. Listeners, have you ever lost your sense of reality, your sense of self, due to illness? We'll talk to Lockwood about what anchored her through long COVID, including finding the funny in the absurdity of it all, and what it says about the things that sustain us in the most disorienting times. Tricia, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. It's so lovely to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you, too. Will there ever be another you? It's not a memoir, but a novel. So tell us about your protagonist and what happened to her when the pandemic hit.
Yes, she does bear similarities to me, as was also the case with my last book. No one is talking about this. So we sort of begin in 2019, before the pandemic hits, and you sort of are introduced to a slippage in reality even before the world goes askew, before it goes a little bit mad. And then starting with the second chapter, The Changeling, we take her into the experience of having COVID and then experiencing strange after effects.
Yeah. In March of 2020, as you say, you are like your character, you got COVID. Can you talk about some of your physical symptoms and also some of the delusions you had?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd love to talk about them because I feel that a lot of times books, novels, memoirs of illness, they really concentrate a lot on physical symptoms. But I think we experience illness just as much with our minds, which was certainly the case for me. Yeah. So in March of 2020, I traveled to Harvard to give a lecture about the internet in one of their stately rooms. And I was up there and looking out at the crowd, hearing scattered coughs come from the rows and thinking, maybe I'm going to get this new thing, whatever it is. And that turned out to be the case. And I went home and experienced something that was, you know, initially just very much like a cold. But then afterwards, maybe about 6 to 8 weeks afterwards, I felt myself slipping out of the world and entering Wonderland, as I called it. Mm. I felt like I was standing 6 inches to the side of myself. I couldn't recognize my own hand. I saw gorillas in the trees. That was one of the funnier ones. So even in that state, you were like, okay, I don't feel like myself anymore. I'm experiencing this strange sense of unreality, but you could still recognize that there were things that were funny about it.
Yeah, you write about experiencing a phenomenon that you called the refrains. Can you describe what that was like?
Yes. So in the book, I have "What is love? Baby, don't hurt me," repeated over and over and over in her mind. But yeah, actually, I would experience that with lots of song lyrics, with things that people said to me, with lines from books that I was reading. And I think, looking back on it, that since I was having trouble anchoring myself in reality, since I was having trouble remembering, this was my brain's way of trying to encode what was going on, to form these new memories in a reality that it didn't understand.
Yeah. Let me invite listeners in. Listeners, have you been affected by long COVID? And does Trisha's experience resonate with you? Some of the things that she's describing, and were you able to find also some of the funny or absurd in the illness? I'm wondering, Trisha, if you could read a little from your chapter called Changeling, and this is at the point when the protagonist has been sick for more than a month.
Yes, so I will do that. She had now had a fever for 48 days. Her head was completely bald because she had asked her husband to shave it, thinking of scenes from old books. Her tongue was purple because she had painted it with something, gentian violet, so that her husband almost screamed when she opened her mouth like a cave at him between kisses. She took wormwood every morning, like a witch from the Bible, and had fallen so far out of the world, out of the human population, that she could not even rejoin them to watch the butthole cut of cats. Sometimes she sat at the foot of the illness and asked it questions. Had it stolen her old mind and given her a new one? Had she been able to start over from scratch, a chance afforded to very few people? Had it optimized her? It had come all this way, she thought, cradling the thing in her chest. Had passed through the hands of an invention or chance, white lab coats, wet markets, the gates of the zoo, to land in her squarely like love. Ground zero, she said to herself sometimes, though what she meant was patient.
That part about, you know, had it stolen her old mind and given her a new one, had it optimized. I'm guessing that also in part you must have had these moments where you wondered if you might never return to your former self again, that you had like a new mind, that you would never feel, I guess, normal, for lack of a better word, again.
Yes, absolutely. And that was really the whole tightrope or high wire act of writing this book. It's one thing to describe a state that you're in that you eventually emerge from. But what if you never emerged? Then the book doesn't end. Then you can never give the reader an ending. You can never carry them out of that place and explain to them what had happened. So I was trusting the entire time that I was describing my symptoms and keeping faith in my notebook and my old rituals of writing, that I would eventually emerge, that I would come back to my old self so that I could tell people about it.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think that helped you cope with whatever, I mean, anxiety or other things that would come up with this idea of I might never come out of this?
Yeah, I do think so, because looking back, I have kept notebooks in my life and, you know, I'll write down passages in books I'm reading that strike me or events of the day, that sort of thing. But I had never kept a notebook so relentlessly as I did when I didn't feel like I could write anymore, when I didn't feel like myself, when I didn't know what was going on in the world. I wrote down everything and I was able to go back and sometimes, you know, determine to the afternoon or the morning, the day, what was going on, what I was taking, how I was feeling, and not just in the physical sense, but also in sort of the mental one.
Yeah. We talked about earlier how you chose to write this as a novel, but you could have probably written it as a straight memoir in the sense that I understand you did not want to make up any perceptions or hallucinations at all in the final.
Yes,
writing
yes.
this book. Why was that important to you?
That was the one thing I knew that I wanted to do. I didn't know what the final shape of the book would look like. But I did know that if I described the sensations as I was experiencing them, they didn't have names, they didn't have labels, definitions. I would simply know, you know, my right hand is turned to a cloud, right? How do I describe that? How do I set that down if I don't know what that is? I thought if I could be accurate to all of that, then eventually I would emerge with some sort of a true picture. And what it would mean, I didn't know. But this was my lodestar. This was the thing guiding me, that I should describe things as they were happening.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you said earlier, I think you were saying that you like felt like you were 6 inches beside yourself or something like that. It made me wonder if, you know,
writing it as a novel, as fiction, and sometimes in the voice of third person, like whether or not it almost reflected the experience of not feeling yourself more accurately.
Absolutely. And actually, I went back and sort of retrofitted something. I put something in the first chapter where I said that some mornings she woke up feeling like herself and then she was I. And then some mornings she woke up feeling not herself and then she was she. So I did choose I determined in the beginning that some chapters would be in the first person and some would be in the third, because that's how it felt. Third person also gives you that freedom as a writer. You may be describing things accurately that are happening to you, but something about the act of stepping outside and looking at yourself as a subject, as an object, helps you get at truths that you might not otherwise put in.
Yeah. We're talking with Tricia Lockwood about the disorienting effects of having long COVID. And listeners, if you've been affected by long COVID yourself, feel free to join the conversation. Have you had an illness that made you lose your sense of reality or sense of self? And in that time, what were your anchors? What do you want to ask or tell Tricia Lockwood? Her other works include the novel No One Is Talking About This and the memoir Priest Daddy. The email address is forum@kqed.org. Find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. So, Tricia, I want to ask you what it was like to engage with the outside world. So, and first of all, to try to tell other people, like doctors and nurses, what you were experiencing.
Yeah. So first of all, we all were shut away at that time. We were in our own apartments, in our own homes, with our own families, by ourselves, just being multiplied, right, with our own fears, perceptions, anxieties. And then you would step out and you would have to encounter a doctor or a nurse and try to describe what was happening to you. And actually, those people were very kind to me. This was very early on, and I think I was one of the first people who was describing some of the stranger effects. So they really did their best. They really, really attempted to help me out. But they didn't bring me back to that sense of reality. It was only, I feel, in 2021 when the world began to come together a little bit, right? It was also as if the world had the illness that we were suffering. So when we stepped back out of it, and for me it was going over to the UK for some of the prize ceremonies for No One Is Talking About This, which had been nominated for some awards. When I got back among people, and I got back among other writers, for some reason, there was something about that that did make me feel like myself, that did make me see some sort of future where I could talk about it, could write a book about it. And I felt like I was at least among my own kind. And if I knew what that looked like, then I was a little bit closer to being me.
Yeah. I do want to ask you, though, about this one moment when you're trying to engage with a nurse about feeling like you're being pulled out of the world by the hair. And this is your protagonist telling the nurse this. And the nurse tries to clarify and says, do you mean that you're dizzy? And in the book, it says, yes, she said after an obedient moment, maybe I mean that I'm dizzy. But she meant that she was being pulled out of the world by the hair. What were you trying to communicate with that?
It's very interesting, because in retrospect, she was right. I was dizzy, but I was experiencing in such a way that I did not have the capacity to find that word. So looking back, what was going on at that time, that was based on a real hospitalization that I underwent, where I was having a migraine with some very strange stroke-like symptoms, which people do have. Migraine can do all sorts of things to people. And I sort of went into the hospital and, you know, they're asking you what's going on, how you feel, and you're really trying to be accurate. But for a poet or a writer, sometimes accuracy is saying, yeah, it feels like my head is a vodka melon rolling backwards off my neck. It feels like I'm being pulled out of the world by the hair. Sometimes you don't have access to those words. It's just like, I'm hungry. I'm burning up. I have a fever. I'm thirsty. Sometimes poetry is what arrives, and that is the only thing that we can offer to describe our experiences.
Oh, wow. I love that in so many contexts. We'll have more with Tricia Lockwood after the break. This is Forum.
Support for KQED comes from Oakland Ballet, presenting Graham Lustig's The Nutcracker, December 20th and 21st, a beloved holiday tradition and magical holiday experience in Oakland's iconic Paramount Theater. Tickets at oaklandballet.org. Support for the KQED car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
On the next Science Friday, the spotted owl has been a conservation flashpoint for more than 30 years, and their newest threat comes from within the owl family tree, the barred owl.
It is almost assured that we will, in fact, lose the spotted owl if we do not control barred owls.
A scientist walks us through a controversial conservation strategy. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
It begins at 11 this morning.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour with writer Tricia Lockwood about the disorienting effects of having long COVID alongside experiencing a very deeply confusing time, the COVID pandemic. And Tricia fell ill with COVID in March of 2020 and experienced long-term symptoms and wrote about it in a new book called Will There Ever Be Another You? It's a novel. And you may know Tricia from her previous works like Priest Daddy and the poetry collections, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals, and Balloon Pop Outlaw Black. And you, our listeners, share how you have been affected by long COVID and if Tricia's experience resonates. Have you ever lost access to language because of illness or found the funny or absurd side of illness? And in a disorienting illness, what were your anchors? Another listener writes, can you tell us about the refrains? Which song lyrics were stuck in your head? You mentioned Baby Don't Hurt Me, but were there any others besides that one?
That was really the big one. It was just over and over and over again. Later on, I talk about something. There's kind of a correspondence where I mention a phenomenon known as my husband's transmissions, which he began to receive after he was hospitalized and had the surgery. And he would hear song lyrics at night and he would sing them to me. So it was almost like that thing that was in my own head was then replaced by this own, like, strange phenomenon that he was undergoing.
Yeah. Steve on Discord writes, I'm still struggling with long COVID and have severe fatigue, low energy, lack of focus, and brain fog. I also have a bunch of other weird symptoms. Many elements of my body are unfamiliar to me after learning them for a lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, do you feel the lingering effects, Patricia, of this time?
Oh, absolutely. So I was laughing with my husband on the way to the studio because I was like, you know, they're going to get this Easter egg. I'm actually experiencing a terrible migraine right now. So, but I was like, it's good because what you show people is that you can go on. You can still exist with these limitations in this altered reality. Sometimes you're compromised. And what has helped me, I find, is just to tell people, you know, that you are now in a little bit of a different world. Like, you're not the same person. I think that you will get better over time. Like, I do believe that that is true. I think that time was the largest component of recovery for me, as well as a couple other things I can talk about if you wish. But part of it is just, yeah, accepting that it will look a little bit different and that people will be accommodating if you tell them about it.
Let me remind listeners, you can find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum at the phone number 866-733-6786 and at the email address forum@kqed.org. Well, in terms of that, yes, you can go on. I mean, in 2021, you were promoting your last novel amidst all of these things that you were experiencing, right? The novel No One Is Talking About This. What was that like and how did you handle it?
Oh, wow. Anyone who released a book in 2020 or 2021 has some war stories to share. First of all, some of those books just sank without a trace. Like, mine was lucky, right? I was being nominated for awards. People were reading this work. And when I picked up No One Is Talking About This and I looked at that cover, wanted, like, with all of my mind, body, soul, to throw it across the room, get it away from me. I was scared of my own work because I felt that it had been produced by a version of me that no longer existed. So all of these things that were, in fact, incredibly wonderful, amazing things to have happen, people reading your book, that's the dream, right? I was like, don't read this book. She doesn't exist anymore. She's not here. Don't ask me questions about it because I can't answer these things for you. But it was very strange. We did a lot of events on Zoom. We did a lot of sort of like long distance things where you just weren't with people and your body really felt like it couldn't find the readers. It couldn't find the audience. If you were reading something over Zoom or over a video interview or something like that, it's like, where are the people? I want to be back in a room with people again, you know, talking to them.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, in reference to interviews that you had to do at the time. You write something like, it felt like everyone in the world had walked into my house and was filming me going to the bathroom. What do you mean by that? Yeah.
It felt like such an unprecedented level of access, and it didn't feel like people should be able to see me that way. There was also the matter of, you know, you're photographed. You do these interviews and then you're photographed. And there was a particular shoot early on where we weren't allowed to be inside because of COVID restrictions. And I think that it was like 25 degrees out or something. So I was out in the cold for like 4 hours posing for this photographer. And then I finally saw the pictures and I looked so sick. And I was like, I knew that I looked different. I knew that you would be able to tell, like you can see it in my face, but I didn't think I looked as sick as I actually did. And that's a hard thing to admit that other people can see about you, right? Like you're thinking this is something private that's happening to me, and my husband, my family. But in reality, everyone knows it about you. Everyone can see it and you feel extremely vulnerable. Uh-huh.
We're talking with Patricia Lockwood, and so are you. Let me go to listener Paula in Oakland. Hi, Paula. Join us.
Hi. Thanks so much for this conversation. I have had long COVID, but that wasn't actually what caused me to lose touch with reality. It was more of a physical symptom. But a few years ago, I experienced iron deficiency anemia, and as a result of that, I had derealization, and it was just a completely out-of-body experience. I was, you know, performing well at work and, you know, still social with my friends, but we rebuilt a fence along a property line with our neighbor, and I ceded about 300 square feet of that property. And it, you know, like at the time I was like, oh, it's no big deal. And then after I got treatment, I was like, what was I thinking? And so now we're having to like pay for surveyors and do all these sorts of things to like go through like reclaiming that land that I was just like, oh, it's A-okay, totally fine. And, you know, my partner was like, it's not. And I'm like, no, it's fine. So it just, you know, now I look back and I have to laugh to keep from crying, but even though it's still ongoing and it's costly, but it was so insane that, you know, that having that experience, and you know about strokes, you know about different, you know, you get a concussion and it's going to impact you, but you don't think about these other illnesses that can really cause you to have, you know, kind of breaks with reality in very odd ways that you don't necessarily recognize. So have a lot of shared experiences with your guest.
Yeah, Paula, did you ever... Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Tricia.
No, that's totally the thing. And it's also like these syndromes are tremendously complex, right? But then also you sometimes just point to something where it's like, hey, you're anemic, take this pill. And then you feel like a total idiot, right? Because you're like, oh, I should have seen that. I should have known that's what was going on.
Did you ever feel like or wonder, Paula, if you were going to get out of it, like that lack of language access and so on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was really scary. Once you realize what's going on and, you know, to your point, that around like taking the pill, I got iron infusions to try to expedite it. But, you know, after the first one, you're not instantly cured. You're like, oh my gosh, have I caused lasting damage, you know, because I didn't know about this condition. Oh. And as you slowly start to emerge and you kind of like, it really feels like you're clawing your way out of like a deep hole and you can kind of see a glimmer of light, but then you might slide back down a little bit. And so, yeah, it's very, and for me personally, you know, I'm not a vain person. I always say, except for my, you know, my cognitive abilities. And so that's why things like dementia and things like they just terrify me, because it's like, that's the one thing that I want to be known for is, you know, my personality, the way I act, the way I interact with folks. And to have that threatened was terrifying. And, even to this day, to your point, Mina, when I feel like maybe something's going on, I get that terror of like, oh no, am I going back into that? Am I going to be able to get out of this? Oh no, I just need to drink some water. And you know, it kind of makes you on hyper alert and very vigilant.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling, Paula, and telling us about that. It's something I want to ask you, Tricia. Like, I wondered if it was harder to lose, to fear, like sort of losing the faculties of your mind, your body, or like, your art, your ability to write, like what feared you most?
Yeah, so that's actually what I was going to say in response to Paula. I was the same. I was like, listen, I'm not as hot as I used to be. Whatever, like that's fine. But my brain, that is my whole deal. This is my entire thing. If I don't have that, if I can't work. But for me, honestly, Mina, the thing that it was that felt the most distancing was not being able to read. Right? I mean, that's something I've been doing since I was 3 years old. Yeah. So before I was a writer, you know, before I was a thinker, before I had these conceptions of myself, I could read and that's what I love to do. And that initial feeling of looking down at the page and just seeing the words jump and jumble and you know that you're not going to be able to make sense of that sentence. Yeah, that was where it was for me. That's what threw me out of myself.
Listeners, have you had an illness that made you lose your sense of reality, your sense of self? What were your anchors through that time? We're talking about it with Tricia Lockwood and her new book, Will There Ever Be Another You? So I talk about how amidst all this, you had to promote your last novel. But the other massive thing is that your husband was diagnosed with a rare medical condition and almost died. Can you tell our listeners what happened to him?
Yes. So we were traveling to London from an event at UCLA that I had done with David Sedaris. And we were going to a prize ceremony, the Dylan Thomas Prize. And about midway through the flight, he came to me and he said, you know, he was white. He looked clammy. He was shaking. And he said, something's very wrong inside me. We thought maybe he had appendicitis, something like that. We landed, rushed him to the hospital. And it turned out he had this very, very rare form of intestinal obstruction called a cecal bascule. And we thought he was going to have to get a bowel resection while we were in London for this prize ceremony, which I did win, by the way. I won that award, which was hilarious in retrospect. But we were actually able to come back to the States and he had surgery a couple months later. And he experienced a bad outcome. He hemorrhaged, and I was his caretaker then for a significant period of time. I took care of what I refer to as his wound. And since no one is talking about this really was a book that was centered on caretaking, I felt that there was a line there, that there was a parallel where it really does return you, you know, to your hands, your feet, your eyes, your hearing, your heart to take care of someone else. You know, you can be experiencing these things, and I did. I would be sick in the midst of taking care of him, but I knew that was the thing I had to do. And I think that that was part of the path to recovery as well. Just like, get on your feet. It's time to do this. You know, there are bigger things than what you're experiencing right now.
Wow. So that was one of sort of your re-anchors, the act of caring, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me go to caller Lucy in San Francisco. Hi, Lucy. Join us. You're on.
Hi. I think you just addressed my question because I am a care manager and I work with people with cognitive impairment, and I have several sort of tools in the toolbox of how people can maintain who they are when things start getting lost, like either word finding or ability to read, et cetera. And you did mention earlier that there were several things that helped you be grounded, including writing. And now I see it's also caring for someone else. Are there any other suggestions you might have of what else helped you stay strong? I mean, it's clearly your personality is driven and motivated, but when you're faced with these kinds of challenges, besides just finding joy in the moment and seeing who you still are inside versus what's missing, what else can you recommend?
Lucy, thanks.
I have something actually so concrete. There is a chapter later on in the book called Beginning Metals, and it is based on a series of metalsmithing classes that I took at my local cultural arts center. And something about the process of learning a totally new skill, learning to solder, learning to braze, learning like all of these techniques, stone setting, it just took me into another world where it was like there was still a new opportunity for the brain to grow and cohere and lead you down a path of illumination. So I would say that, and I don't know if that's along the same lines as telling people to do crossword puzzles or that sort of thing, but I really felt like it's toward the end of the book because I felt that it was so much a part of the recovery process, but just like being with other people in a process of learning helped me immeasurably. I could not recommend that more highly.
I also loved, selfishly, your description of the positive effect of watching Korean dramas. Because I knew so many of the shows you were referencing, right? Because they were like such COVID era period. It's the chapter Boys Over Flowers. Can you talk about watching those dramas and like actually being almost euphoric about being able to understand them?
Yes. Oh my God. They helped me so much. So my husband grew up in Seoul, South Korea. His parents were Baptist missionaries. And so I was like, hey, you know, one day, like, you want to watch this show? Crash landing on you, like you want to give it a shot. You might see something you recognize. You might like hear some Korean, like remember some Korean. And he didn't want to do it at first. And then we started watching and we got sucked into the world of K-dramas, which everyone who has been sucked into that world, they understand, right? They're like, oh yes, you can make that your entire new personality. And for a while, it was just so soothing to me because I think something about seeing the subtitles, seeing different tropes, seeing the sort of different acting styles. Like I became very enamored of like the comedic acting of the Korean actors. And I really wanted to know more about that, how they were doing these things, but also just being like, I've never seen one of these before. I don't know how they work. Anything could happen. You felt your brain begin to grow in that direction too, of like comprehending this sphere that you had never even glimpsed. So we really bonded over that. That was part of the time that my husband was recuperating as well. And I thought of those shows. I thought of Seoul. I thought of South Korea, you know, as a place where my husband was okay because he was a kid there. He was a thriving kid who was not sick. You know, the bad stuff hadn't happened yet. And for me, it was a kind of like idol or paradise to be able to think about him in that place where nothing bad had happened yet.
Yeah, yeah. And also K-dramas are so good about like really hitting you over the head with the moment that you need to pay attention to. Like they have those like freeze frames, right?
Oh, I love the freeze frames. But also I just found like those shows are so beautifully lit and the camera shots are just like, they're these wide sort of static shots that rest on human faces. And I was like, you know, watching American shows with all these like jumpy cuts and like, I don't know, some guy with a gun is like running across the desert. I'm like, I don't need that. I like these peaceful moments between human beings, right? Where I'm being shown what is happening between them. So yes, immensely helpful. I loved my K-drama period for all that it gave me.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, not to sound corny, but I do think it sounds like that what also sort of kept you oriented or served as an anchor was just really embracing and turning to the people that you love, right? Even in the moment of vulnerability, just like leaning on those most powerful relationships.
Yeah, I really think so. I mean, people ask me and my husband about it sometimes, you know, the fact that we were so sick together at the same time. They're like, do you feel like it's different now? Do you feel more bonded? And he's like, you can't even understand how it feels to have gone through something like that and come out on the other side. You are like, you know, locked hand in hand. It's this amazing experience in a way to be able to trust each other to, you know, help you to carry the other through. And it was something I experienced with my niece, but he had not experienced that. And so he was able to see that too. It was really quite an incredible experience.
We're talking with Tricia Lockwood about the disorienting effects of having long COVID alongside a deeply confusing time where we were trying so hard to figure it all out. We're talking about the humor and absurdity she found in her illness, which helped to cope in some ways, and also other anchors and what those anchors can tell us about what gets us through disorienting illnesses and disorienting times. Tricia Lockwood's book is Will There Ever Be Another You? And listeners, you are sharing if you've been affected by long COVID and whether Tricia's experiences resonate with you. Have you ever had an illness that made you lose your sense of reality, lose access to language, a sense of self? What were your anchors? The email address, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Rishi writes, in September 2023, I was running, biking, gymming, working until I got COVID-19. I haven't run or gymmed since and have to allot a rest day after an outing. I'm hesitant to call it long COVID and often suspect an iron deficiency like the other caller, but not a clear clue. Maybe it's just my 40s. More after the break. I'm Bina Kim. Coming up Monday on Forum. Have you ever wanted to erase a painful memory? It's a question at the heart of neuroscientist Steve Ramirez's research. In groundbreaking experiments with mice, Ramirez and his team have succeeded in turning individual memories on and off, even implanting new ones. He says that someday we'll be able to do the same in humans. But should we? We talked to Ramirez about the ethical dilemma and the personal experience that caused him to consider erasing his own memory. His new book is How to Change a Memory. For past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Tricia Lockwood, author of the new novel, Will There Ever Be Another You?, about the disorienting effects of a woman having long COVID in the midst of a very confusing and disorienting time. And listeners, asking you if you've been affected by long COVID and whether the things that Tricia is describing resonate with you as well, or just an illness that made you lose your sense of reality or self and the anchors that helped you along. And Tricia, I'd love if you could read another passage for us from Will There Ever Be Another You that you know, really gets at the absurd, the humorous, and also the challenges, right, of being in long COVID while everybody else is also, you know, disorientingly trying to make their way through a pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Before she learned of the existence of alien hand syndrome, she had tentatively diagnosed herself with a new illness called Who Foot Is That? The main symptom was gasping when you saw your own foot. Has anyone else felt like a child again? I have dreams now like never before. Bizarre nonsense dreams in which I'm not me, or even a human being. Like I dreamed I was a green leaf. I wasn't me as a leaf. I was just a plain ordinary leaf. When I woke up, I was disoriented to find out or remember that I was a human being, and I was me. It was very disturbing and shocking. I've had that happen several times since I first got sick in March 2020. Not always a leaf, but always an inanimate, non-human object of some type, and I really believed during the dream that I am that thing. People had Alice in Wonderland syndrome, and something called drunk baby head, and dark glittering damage to their vagus nerve. People were writing poems about it, she said whenever she saw one, though she used to write poems about everything that happened to her. People had Brian fog, oh no, and people did not recognize themselves. People stood in front of the mirror in the bathroom, flicking the lights on and off to see if their pupils were the same size. My boogers have not been normal for 9 months, one man despaired, and even worse, I no longer have the desire to make money, said another. I feel like I am a piraha, suffering alone in my hell. The CEO of Texas Roadhouse killed himself, no longer able to bear the continuous ringing in his ears. In his lengthy obituary, the newspaper printed the quote, "We're a people company that just happens to serve steaks." The sentence stayed with her long afterward, shrilling at her temple like a mosquito. "We're a people company that just happens to serve steaks," she would say to herself, surprised by the sight of her own foot.
Tricia Lockwood.
So here's another refrain.
Yeah, exactly. Will there ever be another you? Yeah, there we go. Let me go to caller Taylor in Fremont. Hi, Taylor. Join us. You're on.
Hey. Hi. So I have had long COVID, and I was lucky in the sense that it didn't affect me physically, but it definitely tremendously affected me mentally. And I was at points where I was in like low-level psychosis from it, and it was terrifying. Yeah. The thing that I used to try and stay sane was I just focused on every banal thing that I could. So like I was, you know, just like, okay, just focus on getting your dishes done. Focus on doing your laundry. Focus on, you know, and I just really rooted myself in, because my memory, my short-term memory was so messed up that, like, when I would text people within, like, 3 or 4 minutes, I would literally have no idea what I said. Wow. And so I was so terrified that I would do things and not remember them. And so it was just, like, living kind of moment to moment and focusing on everything that in the past
bored the hell out of me because who loves doing dishes?
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, every day I would write a list of everything I could remember that I did. And I just like, I got really, really structured and I like wrote everything down. I read all the long COVID Reddits I could find. The thing I wanted to bring up though that I don't think has been mentioned yet is that in my experience, and I for a while had been dating somebody that also had long COVID, and in a way I was lucky because I got to see symptoms in him before I experienced it, but everybody thought I was fine because for some of us, we present fine. And I don't know if it's just muscle memory or what it is, but you present fine, but internally you are not fine. And I would tell people this, but I think because I was presenting okay, people didn't really, they couldn't really grasp what was happening, despite how many times I would express what was going on. So,
Well, Taylor, thank you. The point about reading or writing a text and then sort of like forgetting that they wrote it or and then reading it and being like, what, I wrote this? That definitely happened to you, Tricia. I remember you writing about it. Yeah.
That totally happened to me. Yes. And I wanted to jump in so badly there because that I really strongly resonated with your description. And also that is a great way to deal with it. All you have to do is the next thing. All you have to do in order to say do a big task is get to your feet, walk to the bathroom, wash your hands, dry your hands. You just have to do the next thing. And then if you can sort of go back over that and be like, I was able to do that, it is very grounding and very anchoring. But yeah, I had entire text conversations I do not remember. And to your point, Mina, about the interviews, what if you give an answer and you don't have any idea what you said? I mean, it's the most terrifying ground being yanked out from under your feet, feeling like, what did I say? You would hang up the phone and be like, well, I hope that was good. I have no memory of what I just came out with. So I experienced that a lot. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you experienced that a lot. Please finish.
So I would often search, in addition to my notebooks, I would go back through text conversations to find when things happen or, you know, like to dredge up some particular memory. And I would just go through them and I'd think, I have no idea, no recollection of that, didn't recall that. That's a funny joke. I'll use that again. You know, it's just like, who's the person typing these things?
I was going to say that I was struck by Taylor talking about how writing things down helped so much, but also how at like the peak time of the pandemic, everyone around you, especially writers, were talking about like, don't write about this.
Don't write about this. Everyone promise. Yeah.
Why do you think they were saying that?
I think we wanted to be able to forget. I think there's a reason, a collective reason why we underwent the sort of cultural amnesia after the first flu pandemic in 1918. I think that we recognized that maybe there was some wisdom to just forgetting what had happened so that we could not be traumatized every moment and we could move forward and we could heal. But also just because it was like writing it down makes it true. You know, I have talked to a lot of students. I've talked to a lot of groups of people sort of after this book coming out. And I'm like, try and remember that stuff. You know, you want to just sweep it under the rug. You want to cover it over so you don't have to think about how painful it was and how much we all went through together. But you are going to want those little details, those little human details. Like, those are history. Don't let them slip away. Don't forget those. But yeah, it was a very funny moment where everyone was like, all right, guys, nobody writes about this. Like, do we agree? And I'm over here and I'm like, I'm going to do it. Like, well, it's going to be me.
Yeah. You did decide to do it. Where do you think we are now with regard to how COVID has entered our literature?
I actually saw a review from someone for a sort of a chronicle or digest about illness and disability. And she's like, counted the number of books that really go into it. And she's like, there's two or three. And will there ever be another you is one of them. And so when you asked me before which part I feared losing the most, you know, whether it was like the brain or the art, the self, you know, the appearance, that sort of thing, I think that I did fear that I wouldn't be able to write a book again. And I think that what the book is really is like showing the process of me putting that ability back together. That's why the chapters look different. That's why some of them take different forms. You just had to learn how to do everything again.
Yeah. So in a way, maybe regaining your sense of self was to write it and to know that you could.
Yeah.
Write it. Then to write a book, which you described almost like a a challenge to yourself to write a masterpiece about being confused.
Right.
I mean, invariably, you have to confuse the reader, right? I'm curious how you balanced that so that they wouldn't be so disoriented, right, that they would close it.
Yeah, this has been a good question that a lot of people have asked. And what I have said is that, especially in the second chapter in The Changeling, you're sort of experiencing the insanity, the disorientation with her. I had to carry you through that. But I also have to promise you with the rest of the book that we come out of it, right? It was the thing that I had to trust in as a person experiencing it. And it's something that the reader has to trust in, that I will carry them out, that there is this glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, that we make it out alive, right?
Yeah. You've also said that you wrote this book insane and edited it sane. And I'm wondering if you did feel like a sense of wanting to make it sane, you know, like really wrestling with what to make sense of and what to leave ambiguous for the reader.
Absolutely. You had to really fight the urge not to make it extremely shapely and remove her actual experience from it. I told another person who asked something similar that, you know, you had to give her her words. You had to give her her experience because this is what it was like for her. And notice that I go right into the third person there again, right? Because that's how it was, right? It happened to someone who wasn't quite me, and I have to respect her and what she said about it and what she told me and the rest of the world about it too.
Did you add in sort of events during the pandemic that maybe hadn't been in your notebooks as kind of anchors to in the madness, just so that people had some sense of time or familiarity, I guess, to grab onto? Like, yes, I do remember when we all thought, you know, ivermectin or something was something that had entered the discourse, you know?
Right. Which is so funny because one of the callers was talking about reading all the Reddits. And if you were on Reddit or those Facebook groups really early on, you saw people trying that stuff before it ever became like a byword in that crazy administration. So you were on the ground floor seeing all of that stuff. But yeah, I like to put in just kind of little anchors. The place for me that was the most fun to do it was in the Artist is Present chapter. Because, you know, a lot of my readers are writers as well. And I think, you know, they're going to remember some of that discourse stuff that we were all talking about at that time, or mentioning, you know, just being able to casually drop that you have an interview after the Capitol has been invaded by insurrectionists. You're like, well, this will put people in time. They'll know that it's January 6th at least if I put this in.
Noelle writes on Discord, yes, I found when I had COVID, multitasking was impossible. Another listener writes, my mom and I went through cancer at the same time from 2016 to 2020. There was nothing more bonding than being in a medical foxhole together, the quiet moments of sheer panic, but also of joy and laughter are indescribable. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Diane writes, Trisha's description of her brain fog is similar to my experience with a brain injury some years ago. You look the same to everyone, but know your reality is different. My new brain works differently from the old brain, which I finally had to accept. Over 5 years, I observed as my brain searched for correct neural connections. I couldn't remember details from my past, nor have more than one thing in my hands at a time, or find words when I wanted to speak. The fog slowly ebbed over 5 years as I came to understand the workings of my new brain. Do you think of yourself as having a new brain, Tricia?
I do, yes. And the thing about it seeking out new connections is very pertinent. I mean, after it initially happened, my brother, who had experienced multiple TBIs in Afghanistan, he said that's how it sounds. Even things like the paranoia, the rage, the uncharacteristic behavior, he said all of that sounds like post-concussive disorder to me. So thinking about it that way is something that I didn't see it happen. I don't know exactly what did happen there, but it kind of fit this profile. That did help. I was like, okay, people have come back from this. You do have to accept a new reality. But also my brain at that time, with things like the refrains, with things like writing it down, I think was just racing to make new connections. It was trying to heal itself.
Yeah. And you've also said during your book tour for this novel that illness, you've come to realize that illness has been a ruling force in your life. And I really reflected on that because, well, first, I'd love to hear how you now think of illness as being a ruling force in your life, but it really is such a ruling force in all our lives, whether we're having the illness or the people around us.
Right. There's no group of disabled and non-disabled people that remain static, right? People from one group join the other group. Like, age, infirmity will bring these things to us all. To some of us, it comes younger, but none of us can think of ourselves as being exempt. But that was pointed out by Tara Menon on my triumphal return to Harvard. And she was saying, you know, these books, Pre-Steady, no one is talking about this. And now this book, these are all books about illness. You know, we had to move back in with my parents when my husband developed cataracts in his 30s, which, like, shouldn't have happened. I had to go back to Cincinnati and be with my sister when her daughter was born with a rare genetic syndrome. And I hadn't seen this. Like, I had not seen this pattern in these books at all. And I was like, it's really like a trilogy of illness and how it does affect every human life. Like, there is no exceptionalism that rescues us from that. And it does make us, I think, into different human beings and more perceptive and caring human beings if we allow that to happen.
Yeah. This listener writes, as a Parkinson's patient, I'm finding it fascinating that so many of what you were describing resembles somewhat my experience as a Parkinson's patient.
Yeah.
Another listener, Larry, writes, I recently realized that the slowness and lethargy I'd been feeling since late June was due to an ongoing battle with high cholesterol. Worst of all was the brain fog, which made me feel less smart than I know I am. This all came to a head a few months ago when I argued with my boss about how competent I was at my job. I realized something was definitely wrong and took steps to fix it, getting a prescription from my doctor. Within a week, my symptoms cleared up, my vitality returned, and my mind felt swift and clear for the first time in over a year. You avoided using any clinical language, anything like that in your book. Why? Why did you do that?
I think I did want us to stay in the garden of perceptions. I wanted it to be like someone was describing a headache for the very first time. That felt to me more interesting, and it also felt more true. But to that man's point, you know, sometimes you just go on Lipitor and you're like, oh, that was the problem all along. When I took my first CGRP inhibitor, which is it's a migraine drug, I first tried the injection called Ajovy, and then I did the once daily pill called Qulipta. I was like, oh, this was the entire time I was in status migrainosis. I was experiencing migraine or migraine aura every single day. All of those things that I thought couldn't be caused by something like that, the memory issues, the numbness, pins and needles, tinnitus, even things like the repeated lyrics in the head, all of those could be migraine. And you just felt like you were suddenly whisked out of Wonderland, and you also felt just a little bit like a dum-dum, right? Because you're like, oh, I can just take a pill, and these things that have been ruling my life and my reality for the past 4 years can go away. It was an astonishing feeling. And there was just a moment where you felt kind of foolish.
Yeah. I hear you're writing poetry again. Is that a significant development for you?
It is, yes. So, will there ever be another you? I say it's in every genre, because those were all the things I had to put back together again. And the one thing that never made it in was poetry. I kept trying to put this one poem about going to the Hall of Miniatures at the Chicago Art Institute right before COVID hit, and it never fit. And then as soon as I turned this book in, it was like some switch just got flipped in my brain, and I started writing poetry. I started hearing that music again. And that was maybe the point at which I was like, okay, I have returned. I can say that, you know, I'm restored to some semblance of myself, because this is the thing that feels closest to me. This is the thing that I was born able to do.
Well, Tricia, thank you so much for Will There Ever Be Another You? It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mina.
And my thanks as well to listeners for sharing their reflections and questions, and to Caroline Smith for producing this segment. This Hour Forum is also produced by Mark Nieto, Marlena Jackson-Pitondo, our engagement producer, Susie Britton, our lead producer. Our engineers this week were Danny Bringer, Christopher Beal, Jim Bennett, Brendan Willard, and Brian Douglas. Our interns are Jesse Fisher and Joy Diamond. Katie Sprenger is the operations manager of KQED Podcasts. KQED's editor-in-chief is Ethan Tobin-Lindsay. I'm Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
Science Friday on the way next. News updates as well from NPR and from KQED with Brian Watt. 10:59, the CHP is at work at this hour in the East Bay. Elaine Leung is here with details.
That's right, Michael. They're running traffic breaks right now. Southbound 680 approaching El Costa, doing so that Caltrans can set up for emergency pothole repair work that will take place in the two right lanes. Better for the Bay Bridge. There is no delay at the toll plaza. However, it is a bit sluggish from the center anchorage as you head out to the central freeway split, and North 101 San Francisco slows 280 to pass Cesar Chavez. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Thank you, Elaine. Traffic support comes from Murphy Mechanic Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Perkins Coie LLP, a legal advisor to established and frontier technology companies in the Bay Area and across the globe. Learn more at PerkinsCoie.com.